You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM. Last month, a coalition of countries began a military intervention in Libya to implement a United Nations Security Council resolution. Military operations began with U.S. and British forces firing over 110 Tomahawk cruise missiles. The U.S. and allied airstrikes on Libya have now entered their second week as part of an effort to enforce a no-fly zone. Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's air force and his long-range air defense systems have largely been destroyed. Canada has also committed 6 aircraft to the operation and a 7th in the area as a backup. In total, Canada has deployed 435 military personnel to the Libyan mission. The intervention ostensibly came about because of the fear that the Libyan dictator was prepared to harm civilians. But concerns linger about the legitimacy and goals of NATO involvement in this North African country. Asla Bali teaches international law at the UCLA School of Law. She has written and commentated extensively on the question of international intervention in Libya. And she's joined me by phone from Los Angeles. Good morning, Asla.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. What are your concerns with regard to the nature of this military intervention?
I think the first concern is that a tactic has been decided upon, namely a no-fly zone and a more extensive aerial bombardment, but without a real clear strategy. And I think we've seen this evolving over the last 3 weeks. I think we still don't know precisely what the strategy is that is behind this, insofar as there doesn't seem to be clear thinking about how to accomplish what appears to be the end goal of the international community that's involved in this intervention, namely the ouster of Gaddafi. So instead what we have is a tactic, massive aerial bombardment, which so far has not proved militarily decisive. It's not possible to provide the support needed to rebels who are poorly organized, poorly trained, to actually oust Gaddafi strictly through aerial support. On the other side, what this tactic does entail is the possibility of very serious civilian collateral damage. Aerial bombardment in the best of times with precision targeting and the most sophisticated weaponry nonetheless is very heavy ordnance being targeted at legitimate military objects, but often military objects that are found in populated civilian areas. And it's important to keep in mind that Libyan civilians live in both the west and the east of the country. So the fact that we are targeting groups that are and military objects that are in the western provinces doesn't mean that we are avoiding civilians necessarily. And while the targeting is certainly, I'm sure, compliant with the requirements of the laws of war, it nonetheless bears the very heavy risk of collateral damage to civilians, particularly given the altitude from which the bombing is taking place and the nature of the ordnance. The choice of using aerial bombardment for humanitarian purposes is a choice that says we value force protection, that is, not exposing our forces to risk at a higher rate than we do the protection of civilians who are on the ground at the receiving end of aerial bombardment.
What other kinds of intervention were possible?
Well, it depends on what date we're talking about. If we're talking about, the sort of third week of March, which is the timing of the Security Council Resolution 1973, then the situation had already deteriorated to the point that it was very likely that some intervention that would be urgent and potentially involve some way of buffering the civilian population in Benghazi from the onslaught of regime forces was going to be necessary. That could have taken the form, for example, of a peacekeeping force that would have been deployed to physically on the ground generate a buffer between regime forces and the civilian population. That would certainly have entailed less risk to civilians, and it would have had the immediate direct effect of enabling protection, direct protection of civilians, and shielding from regime forces. That did not happen, and as a result, of course, as we've seen over the last 3 weeks, notwithstanding aerial bombardment, the regime has continued to be able to target civilians on the ground, and the rebel forces have lost whatever land they were able to gain in the first days of the aerial assault as a result of their poor organization and training. But the real question shouldn't be what could have been done on March 17th or March 19th. The question is what were available measures to the international community at a much earlier stage and throughout. And here I think the initial mistake was really the first Security Council resolution, 1970, which instantly resorted to coercive measures, namely an arms embargo, travel ban, asset freeze, and the referral of the regime to the International Criminal Court. That referral essentially signaled to the regime that they were not going to be permitted to have an easy exile to post-despotic retirement in the way that Hosni Mubarak and Ben Ali of Tunisia had seen just weeks earlier. Rather, the prospect for Gaddafi was a prison cell in The Hague, potentially as a result of the ICC referral. That would disincentivize this regime from seeking an exile strategy, and I think that was a terrible error. What the international community should have done, in my view, is invested massive diplomatic resources in outreach to this regime to get them to desist and to leave, whether that means dealing with parties that are considered distasteful by the West, such as Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, or the leadership of Burkina Faso, or Mali, or other countries that have been discussed as potential locations for asylum for the Gaddafi regime. That would certainly have been a better strategy from the perspective of the humanitarian welfare of the Libyan population than coercive options, which essentially seem to have incentivized the regime to dig in.
Well, you mentioned the confused strategy. I wonder if that confusion has arisen because of there's different. Some people want regime change, and some people want some sort of division of the country. Is that where this the confusion is stemming from?
Well, to begin with, both of those options are deeply problematic. In other words, the Security Council in no way authorized either of those options for the international community to impose on Libya, either a partition or regime change. Those both, you know, greatly exceed the legitimate basis for the Security Council authorization, which was strictly the protection of civilians. But I agree with you entirely that those appear to be the two options most likely to result from the tactic that was adopted, namely massive aerial bombardment, and both of them are, you know, problematic for different reasons. But I think the real source of the strategic indecision and confusion that we're seeing on the part of the allies that are involved in this intervention is their own lack of knowledge and certainty about who exactly this intervention is benefiting. Namely, they do not have reliable information and intelligence about who is, in fact, comprising the rebel forces in the eastern provinces. On the one hand, these rebel forces have very attractive interlocutors with the West, individuals who are Western-trained academics, who are using the vocabulary of democracy and civil society and so forth, and are essentially committed to a set of principles that are very much consonant with what the international community, or at least Western powers, would like to see as a day-after scenario if Gaddafi were to be ousted. However, what's not clear, I think, to any of the NATO powers that are involved in this intervention or anyone else is the extent of support and popular legitimacy that those privileged Western interlocutors have domestically, or whether in a day-after scenario other forces from the eastern provinces might instead emerge as the more locally legitimate. And if that were the case, the international community wishes to assure itself as to who such potential day-after leadership, what it might look like. And of course, again, it's very problematic from the perspective of the Libyan population for the international community to be at this point the appropriate arbiter for who should serve as a leader of Libya in a day-after scenario. But nonetheless, I think that that's what's motivating the delay, the incoherence of the strategy, the fact that there is no clear day-after agreed-upon scenario by the members of the international community because they're not exactly sure who local actors on the ground are.
Well, the strategy that the intervention has taken is one of aerial bombardment. And earlier this week, Gaddafi forces claimed that Western bombs had killed a baby, and there are reports that new airstrikes have killed at least 40 civilians. Could this bombing campaign backfire in the sense that Gaddafi could begin to look like a hero fighting a foreign occupation?
Yes. I mean, we have no way of gauging at this point what the level of support is that Gaddafi actually enjoys in either the Western provinces or in any other part of Libya. But there's reason to think, first of all, because of the tribal composition of Libya, that there are at least some parties on the ground that, to begin with, simply support Gaddafi as a result of their longstanding ties and allegiances domestically. And secondly, Gaddafi has certainly sought to portray himself at this point as a resistance figure that is essentially representing the desires for autonomy of third world leaderships against forced recolonization. That's the way he has chosen to frame the events that are taking place right now. And if this becomes a very protracted conflict, if this becomes a conflict in which the West is increasingly directly involved either in the financing or arming of rebels or on the ground, as we've seen in recent days, verifiable or apparently confirmed reports of CIA operatives now on the ground in the eastern provinces, the more we move in that direction, the more Gaddafi will be in a position position to spin this as an instance in which another Arab leader is resisting a foreign occupation force. Now, I don't mean to suggest that that's valid, that that's in fact an appropriate analysis, but it is certainly the case that it could hand a PR victory to Gaddafi, particularly if this becomes a protracted and indecisive conflict. And unfortunately, we do appear to be heading in that direction insofar as, again, aerial bombardment has not been militarily decisive and the rebel forces are seemingly incapable of gaining ground absent additional and more direct support from the West.
Earlier, you mentioned Hosni Mubarak and the post-dictatorship incentives that were offered to him. That has not happened. That has not been employed here. Those incentives have not been employed here. It raises the question as to whether or not a double standard is being employed, one for American allies and one for countries which are not allied to the United States. Is there a double standard, in fact, at work?
I think that has to be the inescapable conclusion because, in fact, whereas it's depicted at the moment as if there's only one intervention taking place, in fact, there are at least two interventions taking place in the region at the moment, since Bahrain is undergoing a very serious intervention by the Gulf Cooperation Council's troops on its ground in order to put down unarmed democratic protesters and to support the brutal repression tactics of the regime. So the international community has elected to tolerate a deployment of troops into a Gulf country with the purpose of bolstering regime brutality against unarmed demonstrators, whereas in Libya, the international community is intervening on behalf of an armed insurgency that is seeking to depose its regime. So the contrast is striking. I think it's difficult to avoid the conclusion that countries that are directly allied with powerful Western countries are going to enjoy a completely different standard when they resort to brutality in putting down protesters than countries that are either directly deemed to be adversaries, a country, for example, like Iran, or are at least outside of alliance schemes and are considered at best an irritant. And that would be the case certainly of Libya, but maybe equally of a country like Syria. I think it's very striking the amount of media attention that has been given to the protests that have been relatively sporadic and while insistent, but in Syria, as compared, for example, to the near zero coverage today of Bahrain and the very comparatively limited coverage of events in Yemen.
Now, this has been called an international coalition, and much has been made of the role of the Arab League. What about the role of the Arab League and the African Union in this coalition?
So I think that the Arab League's strategy here is a very interesting one and one that should really be closely attended to. First of all, Gaddafi, of course, is unique insofar as he is isolated in his region. He has managed, in fact, to unite Saudi Arabia and Hezbollah, otherwise direct adversaries in almost every other respect in terms of their ambitions in the region. But in the case of Gaddafi, because his regime is held responsible both for the disappearance of the Hezbollah leader and very popular Shiite cleric Musa Sadr, and also he's held responsible by the Saudis for an attempted assassination effort in the early 2000s, both parties and most Arab states view Gaddafi as, as I said, an irritant at best, an adversary at worst, and as a result, almost all countries in the region were united in their willingness to see him turned into the Arab despot that is internationally dispatched in this season of Arab discontent. So the regional scheme also worked against the Gaddafi regime in this instance. However, I think the precedent that the Arab League wished to set here is that it will only be appropriate to allow international intervention in an instance to depose an Arab leader where the Arab League itself has lent its badge of legitimacy to that effort. So in other words, it's a defensive move on the part of regime leaders, which are all of them themselves despotic, and many of them themselves facing domestic uprisings at home, demanding the same things that Libyan protesters were demanding. Their message to the international community is, when we say it's okay, you may intervene on behalf of democratic opponents, but at all other times, we are the arbiter of the legitimacy of our regional regimes. And that's, of course, both a disturbing message and also an understandable one from the perspective of the despotic governments that make up most of the representatives at the Arab League. The African Union, in the end, did not lend its support directly to this call for intervention. They did want to see, for example, a regional force potentially either as a negotiating structure or as a peacekeeping force, but in the end, I think this no-fly zone exceeds anything that the African Union had been willing to endorse.
Now that these forces have been engaged, what outcome would you like to see take place?
I think that at this point, one should still be pursuing, to the best of the abilities of the international community, negotiated exile strategies. And I think there were some encouraging signs last week that there were efforts on the part of regime insiders to negotiate either with the British or with others to reach out and see what exit strategies are available. The best outcome at this point from the perspective of the Libyan civilian population is for the Gaddafi family to find its way outside of the country in as peaceful a way as possible, since it appears that militarily deposing the regime is going to take a long and protracted conflict at potentially great risk to civilian lives. And on the other hand, it also appears that the international community will not desist from the current strategy until Gaddafi has been ousted. So I think all energy has to be focused on getting the Gaddafi family and regime insiders to agree to an exile to wherever as speedily as possible in order to bring this conflict to a close.
Well, thanks so much, Asla, for taking the time to discuss this with us today.
I'm delighted. Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Asla Bali. She is acting professor of international law at the UCLA School of Law. She has written and commentated extensively on the question of international intervention in Libya.